I'm Jonathan Green, and on Blueprint for Living, time for Lost and Found. If you've been with us over the past few weeks, you'll know we've been in search of the Australian modern. We've been travelling to each Australian capital city to find gems of Australian post-war architecture. If you've missed any of the ones we've done, check them out on the Blueprint page on the RN website, or of course on the ABC Listen app. This week, we're off to Perth. To begin, the authors of Australian Modern Architecture, Landscape and Design 1925-1975, Hannah Louie and Philip Goad.
One of the key aspects of modernism in Perth was, if you like, the densification of cities, which is occurring across the rest of Australia. But in Perth, you have someone like Harold Krantz, who forms the company of Krantz and Sheldon. And Sheldon is Robert Schaffrig. And they specialise in functionalist flats. And in many respects, their output is more than what you might experience in some place, in a place like Melbourne. And so housing, dense housing, is, I think, one of Perth's great contributions pre-World War II.
Hannah, Perth is, of course, the city of your birth. This is your home.
Yes.
Take us on a tour. What should we see to glimpse the Perth modern?
Well, you've got to put your walking shoes on because it's quite a large city to walk around, actually, when you're walking around the river. But I think a good place to start would be to go up onto the viewing platform of King's Park and look down on the Narrows Bridge and the freeway interchange that was landscaped by Ray Oldham. And in the book, we've got an exquisite watercolour of his vision of a kind of natural oasis in amongst that interchange, which you may not, you know, associate with freeways, but it is still a very gardened place. But it also talks about that slightly vexed relationship of Perth to its river that it's still working through with things like Elizabeth Quay. But then if you turn around and you look the other way down Kings Park Avenue, you see a very imposing government building of Duma House that was built on the crest of a hill and very controversially one of what was planned to be a kind of Corbusier city of administration on the top of the hill, but only one tower was built. And from there, you could turn right and look at the very emasculated barracks arch building, which was threatened at the time with this sort of wholesale redevelopment of that part of the city. And that battle ignited early conservation movements to at least save a fragment of it from what was seen to be quite aggressive change in the city.
Did Perth's isolation, its geography, did that affect its architecture, the way in which people built in that place?
I think so. And I think it's still playing out in the way that Perth is thinking about its history of modernism and defining itself as having slightly different influences than other places. And it has particular characteristics that come out in the book, I think, particularly the use of off-form concrete in buildings on university campuses, particularly by the architect of Gus Ferguson, who was instrumental in changing the landscape of education. And you really see some fantastic off-form concrete sculptural buildings that in that Perth quite harsh light look quite unique.
It is such a different light in Perth.
Yeah.
That was Hannah Louie describing that crisp white light that you get in Perth. You also heard Philip Goad. We're about to go for a wander around a building that makes great use of that tight West Australian light. The Council House. The ABC's Joanna Trilling met Dr. Simon Pendle, Senior Lecturer in Architecture at Notre Dame University, to discover this once controversial building.
In basic terms, it's a big rectangular glass box, which sounds terrible, but it's incredibly refined. It sits about a story and a half above ground level, at that ground level, so it's more generous as you enter. The T structures which pepper the external facade really glow white in the sun and provide dappled shade over the whole building.
And it's those T structures that people would recognise the building for?
That's right. I mean, it's really it's one of a kind in that regard. And the ground floor is interesting in that it was a late design change by the architects. Once they changed from a concrete to a steel structure, it meant that they took the decision late in the piece, rather than having the columns which would have been on the outside of the building coming to the ground, which would have made it feel a lot heavier, they created these large beams that sit underneath the first floor, which are now clad and then clad in Carrara marble. But the legs of those are pulled to the centre of the building, which allows the edges of the building to cantilever, which just means that it's very light, it's very heavily glazed, and all the detailing of the steelwork and so on is very crystalline. Standing in the foyer, we're now in a glass enclosure that goes all the way to the building's periphery, but originally only the eastern half was fully glazed. The western half was really an undercroft, which allowed a staircase to come down into that public space, but also gave a gathering space that looked onto Stirling Gardens.
And then as you exit the building looking towards the river facing south is where they were going to build, or where the proposal for the concert hall was. What is this area?
So this area, we're sitting really on the one quarter of what's now called Stirling Gardens. Of course, originally and still now, this is Whadjuk Noongar land. Interestingly, the garden was created by James Stirling despite prior land ownership. And he used Aboriginal prison labour to cut down the existing bushland and commissioned a publicly accessible horticultural garden for produce, and it produced some of the food for some of those early colonists. It really probably could be described as sitting very comfortably within a modernist tradition. It's a particularly specific part of that canon. It would sit within the group of buildings that would sit comfortably amongst others, such as those by Mies van der Rohe. It's a very crisp, refined, crystalline building, very elegantly detailed. Everything's very refined, very sharp. It's not the kind of modernism that's sort of handmade and slightly rustic. It's very much of its time, and really what it spoke to was Perth's optimism of the era and its entry onto not just the national but onto the international stage by commissioning a building of this calibre.
And is there anything that sets it apart that makes it uniquely West Australian, or really is it just a copy of that modernist style of the time?
It is, like all forms of modernism that came to Australia, it was locally adapted. Largely that was around probably two things: the technology of construction at the time, but also the local climate. So having a crystalline box that might have been, in its purest sense, in a European setting, wasn't going to cut the mustard down here with the Perth sun. And so the architects introduced these T-shaped shade structures to deal with not just the northern sun, but east, west and south sun. They do an almost good job. They were never quite deep enough to do it fully. They are absolutely a part of the building of a local language of modernist work at the time.
Just for people who may not be familiar with the building, if you were walking down the street, how would you know which building it is?
It's probably because it's one of the buildings that has a very pronounced forecourt. So it sits back from the street, which was typical of that manoeuvre amongst modernist buildings of the time, to set back from the street and create a plaza, as opposed to turn-of-the-century buildings that would be built to the zero-lot boundary. And that was really intended in the European and the American context to allow these buildings to sit free of that context. But with Perth not being particularly built up, it didn't operate in the same way. It really makes the building work in the round, in the landscape, rather than giving it breathing space in the context of a built-up city.
A tropical sun beat down on Perth. This lovely city, only a few miles up the estuary of the Swan River, can do with a breeze from the Indian Ocean when the mercury's up in the 90s. But on the eve of the Games, nobody minded the heat, for all roads led to this beautiful capital of Western Australia. What a magnet these games have become.
Take us back to the role the Empire Games played in its construction.
Well, I think the Empire Games was really providing a couple of things. One was that it was providing a very convenient end date to construction. Convenient in sort of the most inconvenient way is that it really had to speed up the process. It's one of those artificial deadlines that sometimes gets set because the main game was that the building was to house the city and its operations. But it meant that the building had to be built very quickly, and it in fact meant that the construction of the building changed from a concrete frame structure into a steel frame structure, which meant that construction would happen quickly. But the benefit of that is that the building took on a lightness and a fragility that otherwise wouldn't have existed had they used concrete.
Council House was designed by two architects, Geoffrey Howlett and Don Bailey. Geoffrey, in particular, went on to have a very distinguished career here in WA. Tell us a little about them.
Well, from what I know, Geoffrey Howlett studied at the AA in London. That was very much the premier school of the time, and from who I was taught by, that school at the time was pushing this kind of cutting-edge modernism. They were at the forefront of that movement. I know that Geoffrey Howlett spent some time growing up in India as in an expat family based in India, and at some point they moved to Melbourne, at which point Don Bailey and Geoffrey Howlett found themselves working together at a premier commercial firm by the name of Bates Smart McCutcheon. That practice was doing large-scale modernist works, most known for MLC and ICI buildings around the country, of which we ended up with one of those. Don Bailey, I'm not quite sure of some of his background. I think he was a Melbourne local, but the two of them obviously struck up a relationship and thought it was a good idea to have a crack at the competition.
So they were dispatched over to Perth. How did they end up here? Or was the building commissioned in Melbourne?
So the competition was run through the city of Perth and was based here. It was advertised as a national competition, which I think goes to describe the kinds of aspirations that the city had for itself. They were really seeking the best of the best. The two architects, Howlett and Bailey, were working for Bates Smart McCutcheon in Melbourne, and they really entered this competition after hours under their own steam. So that meant that, and this is something that was passed to me from Don Bailey directly, was that they worked at night and weekends late into the night from his front room in Hawthorne, burning midnight oil, being fed by Don's wife, probably drinking too much and definitely smoking too much as they laboured away in an extracurricular way.
Because they would have been relatively early in their careers, in their late 30s, so this was a big deal for them, a big project to be working on.
Yeah, I guess it's a sign of the ambitious nature of younger architects. From memory, they're around about 38, which is young in an architect's life, but it's not too young to know what you're doing. And I think it's tribute that at the time, the city was prepared to trust a couple of 38-year-olds to execute a building of this scale and complexity. And it was also something they were comfortable doing. They'd been working at Bates Smart on similar kinds of buildings. They had a very, very good grounding in what they were about to do. And in fact, I think it's fair to say they evolved that language into something far more specific and of a higher order than they'd been doing at Bates Smart.
You're listening to Lost and Found on Blueprint for Living. I'm Jonathan Green. Our search continues for the Australian modern. We're in Perth. Part of our quest to learn about Australia's best modernist buildings. If you've been listening in, you've likely been won over by Perth's Council House, its T-shaped shades, its clever use of light. But it wasn't always Mr. Popular as a building. This wasn't the case in the early 90s. At around its 30th birthday, the state government in West Australia had that building slated for demolition. Now, they said that Council House did not fit in with a vision of a heritage precinct. The plan was to grow garden in the place of that building, something that wouldn't stick out so much in the surrounding 19th century built environment in that area. The public sentiment on whether Council House should stay or go was pretty evenly divided. It was a regular talking point in the media at the time. Here's part of a letter to the Australian newspaper from June 1994. My trouble with Council House is that visually, it mainly consists of Venetian blinds, an unaesthetic and unimpressive construction material. Here's another from a long-time resident of Perth. I went through a stage of thinking the building had as much grandeur as a sack of wheatbelt motels. Now I think it stands in glorious contrast to the earlier buildings around it. Well, Council House attracted strong advocates in the form of the Royal Institute of Australian Architects. The WA chapter vehemently opposed the demolition, along with political advocacy group City Vision, and they successfully argued for the Council House to be kept. Said architect Bruce Callow, "Over time, the city should contain examples of all the significant periods of its development. Wherever possible, they should be the best examples, not just what was left over from that period." In 1995, a newly elected Perth Council reviewed the demolition plans and voted to refurbish the building instead.
And they took quite a holistic approach with the design.
That's right. There was really an integration of many facets of the building. It wasn't just the architecture. There were carpets commissioned specific to the building. The architects designed the furniture, much of which was lost during the renovation in the 90s and is distributed throughout Perth, owned by many architects and others. But they were also designing the uniforms of some of the staff, the cutlery I was told they designed for the reception room. And then there were major artwork commissions, so the crest outside the front door was commissioned, and then they worked with Helen Gray Smith, who was a local artist and textile designer, and she made the curtains for the eighth floor, which were really beautiful objects of art in their own right.
They went on to build some other very prominent buildings, one just down the road, the Perth Concert Hall. They were also involved with Beattie Park.
That's right. I mean, Beattie Park was a beautiful little building. It was very small. It was a kiosk, and I remember it as a kid. Very Meesian, you would say. So that's coming from Mies van der Rohe from Germany, and unfortunately was lost in their expansion. But they became really one of the premier practices in Western Australia of their era. So, yes, they designed the Perth Concert Hall, which is a couple of doors down the terrace. They also designed Mount Newman House, which is wrapped around the Cloisters building, also on the terrace. They designed the Reserve Bank in Canberra, a number of schools, a number of houses. So they were really one of three or four premier practices in Perth at the time.
They were very involved with the interior design of the building. You mentioned also the uniforms of staff, cutlery. Is it true they had gold-coloured Venetian blinds?
That's right, and that's another tragic loss from the renovation. I mean, the renovation did a fairly good job, but one of the things that was lost was the gold Venetian blinds, which, I mean, colleagues of mine, we talk about sort of entering the city and by having so much glass, as typical for Perth, anywhere that the sun's coming in, the blinds are permanently down. And seeing those gold blinds go up and down through the course of a day, it was really, again, this sort of glistening object that just reeked of optimism.
And those beautiful teas that you described at the beginning, which anybody who has been down the terrace will know that is what this building is known for, they weren't just there for good looks. As you mentioned, they were also there to provide protection from the sun.
That's right, really both. And I think whilst giving some degree of protection from the sun, although not full protection that you would design nowadays, they really give the sense of scale to the building, so they make a big building feel far more, I guess, decorative, if for want of a better term, and they give the sense of a precise kind of handicraft because they're clad in or wrapped in a very small glass mosaic tile, so there's a great sort of material quality that they do glisten in the sun. They've had this sense of precision that might have been possible in something like precast concrete, but a greater material depth because they're clad in basically little pieces of glass.
And that precast concrete shading was quite a new concept at the time.
Yes, absolutely. It's something that allowed things to be factory built. It meant that precision could be achieved, and it meant that the project could be constructed quicker. The ninth floor is really the main engine room, if you like, of council business. It's the location of the council chamber itself, and therefore is an important floor because it houses not just that function, but it also provides democratic access to that floor for anyone wanting to partake as a member of the public.
Back when this was built, the mayor had a reception suite for visiting dignitaries.
That's my understanding, is that that would have been the first space completed in time for the Empire Games, because they needed a reception suite for the Empire Games, as well as a mayoral suite and a civic reception space, which really combined a sort of a restaurant function.
And the mayor's nickname was Tom the Cheap?
That is true. And there was always a joke around town that the T's of Council House derived from that nickname. And he got that nickname because he was a local businessman that had that as part of his slogan. But of course, he was obviously someone with a bit of vision, along with the town clerk at the time, who managed to procure a building of such importance.
And those T's are reflected even in the carpet where we're sitting. It's not the original carpet, but it's a replica.
That's right. I guess that's part of the heritage work and conservation work that went into the restoration of the project and the refit of the project in the 90s, which carry that motif through.
Perth almost lost this building in 1993. It was riddled with asbestos. Tell us what happened.
Well, that's probably a long and complicated story, but in short, the city had come to the conclusion that the building was reaching its design life. Certainly things like the services and elevators and so on were starting to fail, and the upkeep was becoming too expensive. The building was, by virtue of that change to steel from concrete, was insulated using spray-on asbestos, which needed to be removed. And there were numbers thrown about the expense of refitting this building, which ended up being inflated. And after an extensive public campaign by the Institute of Architects, various members of the profession, various members of the public, it was really navigated and the realisation that the building could be refitted for less money and could be maintained and was in fact a really important cultural icon.
Well, the state minister at the time refused to heritage list it.
Well, that's right, and that's a great pity. And I think what that really represented, and as someone who was in architecture school at that time and was contacting members of parliament, including my own father, about doing something about this, there was a great divide in that if buildings were ugly, they had no inherent merit. And of course, if you go through the borough charter, and buildings have all sorts of merit, which could be aesthetic, could be cultural, could be an association with important events or functions. It could have been a technological basis for retention. And when you view that document, Council House rated extremely highly on all of those five criteria.
Definitely seemed to tick quite a few of those boxes. So the building was saved. What happened to some of that specially designed office furniture that you mentioned?
Well, I think it was gotten rid of by and large. I'm not sure if it was a controlled process or if it was determined that some would be retained and some would be let go. But certainly there's an awful lot of architects and others around Perth with that furniture in their houses. And bringing that up one time with Don Bailey when he visited Perth, he was horrified by that notion that this stuff had left the building and was now all strewn throughout the suburbs. But coming back here today for the first time in a little while, it's great to see the city is clearly starting to put that on show and may even be acquiring more of it, I'm not sure.
Where we're sitting right in the council chambers, there are at least two desks that look like they're original pieces, would you say?
That's right. And in the front reception, there's the couches, the armchairs and the coffee tables. They were designed locally, made locally, and then went on to become retailed via David Fuchs Taylor's showroom, which is now the Institute of Architects on Broadway, Netherlands.
You've been listening to Lost and Found, a Blueprint for Living production this week in search of the Australian modern in Perth. You heard Joanna Trilling speaking to Simon Pendle, a senior lecturer in architecture at Notre Dame University, about Perth's Council House. Thanks also to Hannah Louie and Philip Goad. Producers are Lisa Devizi and Rosa Ellen. Technical production by Melissa May. Next week, we're off to Darwin. I'm Jonathan Green.